everybody. This is James Lindsay. You are listening to New Discourses Bullets, where I give a single bullet point like summary of something relevant to wokeness that we need to know so we can defeat it. And this is a special episode. I usually talk about something woke, and I try to explain maybe political warfare or a woke concept or a woke tactic. And occasionally I take time to describe something kind of more fundamental on the other side. What are solutions? This isn't exactly a solution podcast. It's more like a solution space podcast. I want to talk about the foundation of the creation of wealth. And to do so, I'm going to kind of refute this kind of idea of inclusion, which is, of course, a very abused term from the woke. And I'm going to give a defense of exclusion. To understand what I'm talking about, I want people to understand that for Marxists or woke, that what they are talking about with inclusion is not merely, you know, letting people into spaces and that. And I'm not going to talk about the misuse of that term specifically. What they are actually refuting is a specific doctrine that's extremely important to Marxists, which is a doctrine of private property. If you look at private property law, which I am not an expert in, but I learned this much about it by studying Cheryl Harris's 1993 essay, Whiteness as Property, which explains effectively, for me, it's kind of like the key that makes it possible to understand why critical race theory is race Marxism. They characterize whiteness as a form of private property, and private property, of course, must be abolished, right, in order to create what? Equity, as we call it now, or actual equality, as the Soviets called it, as the ultimate goal. Not just economic equality, but equality in all domains of being. Therefore, actual equality, or sometimes factual equality. Okay, so the idea is that they have to overcome private property. But there are certain doctrines that define property as being private. And the key one of these is called the fundamental right to exclude. In other words, if I have some piece of private property, let's say it's my shirt, and you want the shirt, I have the fundamental right by ownership to exclude you from having my shirt. And it doesn't have to be a shirt. It could be my money. It could be my home. It could be any object that you can think of. I have the fundamental right under private property to exclude you from having my stuff unless we agree upon an exchange voluntarily. And you have the same right, and everybody in a society that guards private property has the same right. This little doctrine turns out to be the foundation for all wealth. I'm not saying it's the be-all, the ends-all. Of course, there are places where the Marxists or even the woke-right distributists will be able to step in and say, you haven't told the whole story. I'm going to disclaim. I'm not trying to tell the whole story. I'm trying to explain how a very fundamental principle, which is called the fundamental right to exclude, which is a fundamental principle of private property, is the foundation for all wealth. I am particularly interested in young people who've had a very poor education in these kind of fundamental matters. I'm very much hoping that young people will hear this and will understand something different about why private property is so central to wealth building and, in fact, to freedom. But I'm not going to focus on the freedom aspect so much today as I'm going to focus on the wealth building. And I mean it. The fundamental right to exclude from private property is the foundation for all wealth building. And here's how it works. Let's say that we have a situation, it doesn't matter how many people are involved, we'll call it a society, and that it secures through whatever means, just government or whatever, it secures individual citizens' rights to private property. And thus it gives them the fundamental right to exclude. So let's say that in that society, I have something that you want. Like I just said, the only way for you to get that thing is to enter into a voluntary exchange. I can give it to you because it's mine and I'm allowed to, but I have the fundamental right to exclude you from it unless the terms of exchange are acceptable. I might care about you, there might be empathy or whatever else, and feel like I should give you the shirt off my back. You might have to buy it. you might have to trade it. Maybe I'm hungry and I'll trade you a shirt for a hamburger, right? This is extremely important. Okay, so I have my stuff, you have your stuff, and if we want to trade stuff, we both have to agree to the terms of the exchange. Do you understand? That's the key right there. That's the magic sauce. Because why would somebody agree to the terms of an exchange of property? Why would you come and say, hey, you have that thing and I want it, and I say, you know what, I'm happy to part with it on the following conditions, and you say, I'm happy to meet those conditions? Because what I just described in that little exchange, abstract exchange, is the generation of wealth. Because the only time that's going to happen is under the condition that both parties are happy to make the exchange. In other words, both parties are happy because they derive more value from engaging in the exchange than they would if they didn't engage in the exchange. That's the heart of voluntary exchange, and voluntary exchange is the result of retaining and securing the fundamental right to exclude in private property. How does it generate wealth? Well, let's say that I have some stuff, you have some stuff, we trade, we're both happy. That means we both believe there was no coercion involved, so we both believe that we left with higher value than when we entered the exchange. That's the only reason we would do the exchange, is because we both believed we have higher value. What that means is we're both holding higher value. We now have more value than we had before. Both of us do. I didn't steal it from you, taking away your value to increase my value. I found a way for you to voluntarily trade with me, so your value went up in the trade and my value went up in the trade. That's called creating wealth. What is wealth? What are value? These are important questions. So value, of course, Marxists try to put forth the labor theory of value, that the labor required to make something is where its value comes from. It's not a very good theory of value. There are subjective theories of value. The value is in the eye of the beholder. But I get kind of to brass tacks about value. Value, thus wealth, by the way, because wealth is like the increase of value or the storage of value or potential value. Value refers to something. Value is evaluative, right? We evaluate things. What does evaluating something mean? It means determining how good it is, right? Or how bad it is. But determining how good something is or bad something is not weirdly universal. It's actually specific. It's not subjective, although there can be subjective elements like it just makes me feel good, or I like it, or it, you know, I want it. But it's not always subjective. It's not always sentimental. Like, you know, that was my dad's shirt, so you're going to have to pay me $1,000 for it since he died or whatever. That's a sentimental, subjective value. But in many cases, if not most cases, value is actually determined according to its ability to satisfy a need. If you have, let's say, a bunch of nails you have to drive into a piece of wood to build a deck or something, you need a hammer. And in fact, you need a good hammer that won't break. So you're going to evaluate different tools, a screwdriver, a saw, a rake, a hammer, and you're going to say the hammer is best for the need that I have, which is to drive in nails. So I'm going to purchase a hammer. I need a hammer that's of good quality, so I'm going to check this hammer versus that hammer. And the quality is going to correlate with price because it is more expensive with raw materials, labor, and so on to build a more expensive hammer. So the people who built it value what they put into it and withhold it because of their fundamental right to exclude. So you're willing to figure out how much you're willing to pay for the quality of hammer you need to do the job. Hammers are good for driving in nails. They're not good for, say, removing a screw or for eating. You might want a hamburger if you were going to eat. If you were hungry, you would not buy a hammer because you don't value it. But if you were really, really, really hungry, you might pay $50 for a hamburger if it were offered to you and withheld for whatever reason because the person on the other end can withhold it. But if you're only a little hungry, you might pay $5. And if you're not hungry, you wouldn't buy a hamburger at all. So there is this element of necessity buried down within the idea of value. We value things for some subjective reasons. We also value things for what we've put into them, some objective reasons. And then there's the necessity argument. So that's very important to the next thing I'm going to say about how the fundamental right to exclude builds wealth. Because let's say that I'm a hammer or hamburger maker. I'm really good at making hamburgers, I realize. Turns out, in any given day, I probably don't need more than two or three hamburgers, and I might not even want two or three hamburgers because I want some variety in my diet. But maybe I can make 50 hamburgers at once pretty, you know, efficiently on my grill. To make one is to do all this stuff. To make two is to do a little bit more. To make 10 is basically to do the same thing really quick. They all go on the grill at once. It's really not that hard. Go down the line, flip, 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 flip. I can make 50 hamburgers pretty efficiently compared to making one hamburger with just a little upscaling of work. And maybe I'm really good at it, so I'm going to be somebody who owns a restaurant. Or maybe I know how to manufacture a hammer really well. Okay, so I make hammers or hamburgers, and I can make more of them than I need. I only need one hammer or two, maybe, or a handful of hammers for whatever it might be doing. So if I have 100 hammers, I don't really need those. The necessity is low. Why? Because I have a bunch of other ones, right? So the value I assess in the hammer is lower than the value somebody who needs a hammer would assess it at. If I've eaten my hamburgers already and I'm not hungry and I have all these burgers left, the value of the hamburgers is lower to me than it is to you. And so we can determine a price of exchange where we both leave happy. And so what that means is I can be incentivized by the fundamental right to exclude. I can make more hammers than I need, and I'm under no obligation to share them with anybody. I could fill a garage. I could fill an airplane hangar. I could fill 10 Olympic swimming pools with hammers, and nobody could stop me if I had the property. I could just pile hammers up as high as I can pile them, and nobody could take them. Nobody can have them, and it doesn't matter that I don't need them. I could hoard hammers because of the fundamental right to exclude. The thing is I don't really have a lot of advantage in that, but if I'm really good at making hammers, or I know that I can make hammers, and I know other people want hammers, and they want to do other things with their lives, I'm incentivized to make a surplus of hammers. So this is another aspect, not just value, but also surplus is a symbol of wealth. Wealth is a result of having value met, which means answering needs. Wealth is a capacity to address needs in some sense, but it's also having a surplus. And as it turns out, being forced to share things does not generate surpluses. People are worried they're not going to have enough. They hold on to what they can get a hold of. They resent being told they have to share it when they don't want to. They resent seeing it mistreated when they have to share it in common. And throughout history, whether it's in Mao's China, Soviet Union, any other communist country, you see the destruction of property rather than seeing it go to forced sharing. However, the fundamental right to exclude allows people to be incentivized to produce a surplus. I want to make, if I can sell stuff that I make, if I have a surplus, I want to sell the surplus. And if I'm allowed to sell stuff that I make for a price that's mutually agreed upon by both parties, I'm incentivized to make the things that I can make for the lowest cost and the lowest effort. In other words, there's an efficiency that comes with it. I'm good at making hammers. You're good at making hamburgers. We find a medium of exchange for hammers to hamburgers. Maybe I give you a hammer. You give me a hamburger. Maybe you don't want two hammers. So when I want my hamburger tomorrow, we switch off to $20 bills. But the point is that I'm encouraged to make a surplus of things I'm good at making, and you're encouraged to make a surplus of things you're good at making. This, you'll hear from the Marxists that the fundamental right to exclude private property and capitalism are doctrines of scarcity because of the fundamental right to exclude. I can make my hammers and I can exclude you from them. So hammers are scarce because as a manufacturer, I can keep you from having them unless you meet my price. No, I'm incentivized to make a surplus of hammers, way, way, way more hammers than I ever need, whereas you can come and buy them and we can find a mutually beneficial rate of exchange, which is called usually the market price when this comes out in kind of the big aggregate. Therefore, you're incentivized to make a surplus. I'm incentivized to make a surplus. Other people are incentivized to make surpluses. And we're all incentivized to trade our surpluses in voluntary exchanges that increase the value held by all parties involved in the exchanges when they occur, which creates wealth, which creates value, which distributes goods and resources and opportunities and services and skills so that we can solve actual problems in life, be those serious problems like You need to be able to build, say, a levee to prevent a flood that's happening with the rain. It's a serious problem. Or put out a fire, or build a deck, which is a little less important, or build a home, which is maybe a little more important, or something completely frivolous, which is to have maybe a nice piece of artwork hanging on your wall. All of these myriad interests and wants and needs, that some of which are subjective, some of which are very objective, and some of which are variable by necessity, can all be satisfied by an economy that enables the fundamental right to exclude, which therefore enables the generation of surplus, which therefore enables the generation of voluntary exchange that increases the value on both sides, which therefore increases wealth overall. So the fundamental right to exclude, which is the core object of the doctrines of private property, which is the piece that the Marxists are primarily against, by the way. They want to be given stuff for free. They believe that everybody should share all the time equally of all their things because they don't want to work for them and engage in voluntary exchange for whatever set of reasons. They hate what they call the realm of necessity, which is actually the basis for much value. They want to abolish the realm of necessity. So this idea, what they want to get rid of in private property, is the fundamental right to exclude. But the fundamental right to exclude is the foundation for the building of all wealth. Do you understand how important that is? So it's extremely important to understand that Marxism, even with all the other reasons, not understanding human nature, blah, 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 being an evil religion, yada, 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 even with all the other reasons taken off the table, Marxism can never succeed. Any actually government-mandated redistribution scheme is doomed to create something less good or to hamper the development of wealth and the solution of problems, which wealth represents as the capacity to solve problems, because wealth is generated by the fundamental right to exclude, encoded in the right to private property, and that right to private property and the fundamental right to exclude, and thus the basis of wealth and the pursuit of happiness, as it turns out, is fundamentally built on the capacity of a state not to interfere, or other powers, coercive powers, a cartel, a monopoly, and so on, to interfere with your ability to engage in the fundamental right to exclude and engage in voluntary exchange because of that with other parties. That's where wealth comes from. That's where surplus comes from. That's where abundance comes from. Don't let anybody, right or left, tell you differently. That's actually how it works.